Mr. John Hankins is coming up right now. I've never met you before, but you're from the director of the Craftsman Guild, correct?
Right.
Wonderful. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very happy to meet Mr. John Hankins from the Craftsman Guild of New Orleans.
Hello, everybody. I am not a good public speaker, so, and I'm old as dirt. So y'all have to bear with me. My mother says I've gotten so old that I can get away with doing things that would probably embarrass other people. And I want to tell you about what we're doing right now. I am the director of an organization called the New Orleans Master Crafts Guild. And what we're doing is trying to revive the building trades among people in our community. Traditionally, some neighborhoods of New Orleans have been known as the home of the master craftsman who built the city. Started out being in Tremaine and the lower French Quarter, what we call the downriver end of the French Quarter. And then in the 20th century, it moved to the 7th Quarter. So, for brick masons and carpenters, you have people up in Carrollton and Hollygrove. So, with the advent of desegregation in the, really in the 70s, all the vocational ed programs in New Orleans, which were some of the best in the country, were dismantled. And they acted as a feeder into the different trades. And then, of course, we became a right-to-work state, and so all the union apprenticeship programs really went the way of everything else that, impacted working people here. So if you're not in a trade that's affiliated with some company, usually a big corporate company that has like a government contract, like, you know, these people who do the shipyards or people who are doing these armored cars and stuff like that, there aren't many apprenticeship programs for you. So this alarmed some people in the city. And so in the late 90s, I used to work at the New Orleans Museum of Art. In the late 90s, we put together a major exhibition. It took 3.5 years to organize, called Race to the Trade, Creole Building Arts of New Orleans. And initially, we were going to just try to identify who actually built the city. We know who owns property and who owns monuments and who owns things in the city. We know families who claim to have been the people who have been the people who have been written up in the history books. But, you know, the question that we wanted to know is, like, who actually did the work? Who built these things, right? I mean, I don't think these people sitting up on St. Charles Avenue built a darn thing. So we wanted to know who built it. So we took 2 years and did oral histories of 55 families of building tradesmen who have been at least two or three generations in the trades. The oldest one did dated back to 1794, who had people continuously in a trade, and the youngest was a second generation person. And so we did this exhibition that turned out to be really kind of interesting because it was not about the architecture per se. It certainly wasn't about the people in the hoop skirts and things who live inside the buildings. It was about the people who built the city. And ever since then, this appeared in like 2002. Ever since then, I have befriended a lot of the people in the trade. So a few years ago, in my post-retirement era, we started this organization to try to recreate a traditional apprenticeship programs to get more people in our neighborhoods back in the trade. And we're proud to say now we're in our fourth year of training people in two of the four trades that we've identified. The two trades that we have apprentices in now are ornamental plastering and ironwork. And the ironwork we do restoration welding and blacksmithing. So we're the guys, we just got the contract to do the restoration of all the ironwork at the Presbyter. We just got finished restoring the fence at around Jackson Square. And the plasterers are the first people we'll call to do any important work. So when Brian asked me to come talk about monuments, I thought, well, maybe I'll talk a little bit about ironwork, because I love to talk about ironwork. And when we do these kind of who built this tours, where we take people around, especially like to take architects who don't know everything, and take them around.
No, we don't. Give a hand.
And actually tell them who helped their name, helped them become so famous by actually creating the stuff that they drew. So when I do like the French Quarter, who built this tour, two of the places that we usually talk about is like the fence around the State Museum. That fence was built by a black man. You know, New Orleans used to have 2,000 blacksmiths, and like 95% of them were black. So yeah, black blacksmiths. Anyway, guy got the contract to build a fence around the second mint in the United States. He submitted his bid. The U.S. Congress approved it. It was going to be the most fantabulous fence around any public treasury building in the country. And since there was only one other one, that was kind of a good thing. But his plan got derailed when the representative from Philadelphia saw the plans for the building, and he amended it to cut his, and also found out that he was black, cut the contract, and it is in the congressional record. He said that he'll be damned if a mint in New Orleans will have a fancier fence than the original mint in Philadelphia. So that's how we have that mint, that fence around there now, which is one of the most sturdiest pieces of ironwork in the Gulf South. It's been there ever since like 1850. The other thing I talk about is the ironwork on the St. Louis Cathedral. How many of you have looked on top of the spires there and you see those like lightning poles, those rods on there? Have any of you recognized the symbols there?
Yes.
Tell them what it is. That's right, they're Sankofa symbols. Because a lot of the ironworkers here used to infuse like a Sankofa as an Adinkra symbol, which is, I think most of y'all know what that is. In any case, on top of the most iconic cat.
Tell them what it is, real quick.
Oh, okay.
Just elaborate.
All right. So, the Sankofa, there are two symbols for Sankofa. One is like a backwards looking bird. And the other is this heart symbol that you see on almost a lot of the ironwork you see around the city. The meaning of Sankofa kind of literally means you have to know your past to move forward. And so a lot of white people, when they were buying, you know, fences and stuff, they were like, that is really pretty, not knowing what it meant. So it's in a lot of the fences you see. When I show you one, you'll go, I see this everywhere. But in any case, it's an Adinkra symbol that that is even on the spires, on the top of the spires at the top of the St. Louis Cathedral. By the way, the facade of the cathedral was done in 1851, primarily by the Barthé family, who have been plastering in New Orleans since 1849. And every time they do work on, they're the only people who have done major restorations there. They write their carved initials in behind the work that they do. So the very first one there is like AB, you know, 51, but that's like 1851. But since we're talking about monuments and talking about ironwork, I want to talk about two pieces of about a monument ironwork. All right. Being kind of self-conscious, I brought AIDS. Take a look. All right, so one of the monuments still standing is the Andrew Jackson equestrian statue in now Jackson Square. That statue is attributed to a sculptor named Clark Mills. And Mills is a very interesting man. He's a self-taught artist who was a handyman who had a lot of different trades, but he happened upon doing public sculpture, but he never had any formal training. And he had no training whatsoever in doing anything like that before. So to commemorate the seventh president's historic victory at the Battle of New Orleans in the nation's capital for the 35th anniversary of that, they wanted to commission someone to do a statue. So Mills submitted a proposal and won the commission. However, he nor any other artist had ever cast a bronze statue before in the United States. So it was all done by trial and error. Now, he is attributed with doing it, but again, you know, do I believe that Clark Mills did any of the work in building that? Well, we know for sure that he did not. So I want to tell you a story about a man named Philip Reed, whose work, you know, is prominent in New Orleans because he was a person who was born in slavery in Charleston, South Carolina, around 1820. At the time, Charleston was the second largest slave market in the country, second only to New Orleans. And he was described as a kind of a well-built mulatto man who was very, very, very ingenious. And so, like a lot of other very skilled craftspeople in Charleston, because Charleston is very similar to New Orleans, he worked in ironwork and in plaster. And that's one of the reasons I like him, because I like anybody who works in ironwork and plaster. And so, in any case, Mills bought him for $1,200 when he got this commission, and they proceeded to try to figure out how to make this statue. As I said, no one had ever done this before. And kind of to make this a long story short, with the ingenuity, with the conceptual skill of Mills, he was a great designer, and he was a great fabricator of face molds. That was his big specialty. But Reed was the guy who knew how to translate that into objects, the tangible things. And so with the ingenuity and also not knowing what they shouldn't be doing, they ended up creating the very first bronze monument cast in the United States. And in addition to that, it became the very first equestrian monument that is supported only by the horse being on two legs. That 20,000-pound statue has to be a metal, has to balance on the two legs, hind legs of that horse. And the one here in New Orleans has withstood everything from hurricanes or whatever and has never had any trouble. And that is a testament to Philip Reed. Now, when I do our tours there, I don't talk a whole lot about Andrew Jackson because he was a despicable person. And I certainly don't talk a lot about, you know, the historic merit of the statue because, again, the purpose for which it was created was just despicable. And I don't give all the credit to Clark Mills, even though he is the designer of record of it. But the people in D.C. who knew Mills knew about Reed. And so his name has popped up from time to time in, like, newspaper accounts, but never in official documents until the casting of the Statue of Freedom, which is the monument that you see that's on the top of the Capitol building there. So Mills won the commission to do the statue at the top of the Capitol building. But it was a monumental sculpture, and it was actually designed by Thomas Crawford, who was a really very, like, a world-renowned maker of statues. He had moved to Rome because everybody would buy their statues in Europe. But between the time that he designed it and the time that the mold was shipped to D.C., Crawford died. So what happened when this thing was shipped here, they had an Italian guy from the foundry to come, and he was supposed to lead in the production of this Statue of Freedom. But being like all good Italians, once he got here and he saw how kind of backwoods the operation was there with Clark Mills and with Philip Reed, and he knew what a big deal this was and how much money had been allocated for it, tried to jack them for more money. So he was like, I'm the only one who knows how to even take the mold apart. So he tried to jack him for more money, and it became a big crisis in D.C. until Philip Reed whispered into Clark Mills' ear, he's like, don't pay this clown. I can do this. He's like, I got you. I can do this. And so he devised this really ingenious way of taking the mold apart, and then they built a temporary foundry at 15th and Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm from D.C. That's like a block away from the White House. And they built the statue, which I passed around, which has just been restored. And so all this time, all this work the Mills has done, he and Reed had never got any credit. But in 1928, some people at a commemoration of this, they discovered the financial records for the payment of the workers for this monument. And there were 20 people who were paid to work in the foundry. And only one of them was black, and that was Philip Reed. So all the white men who worked in the factory got paid $1 a day. Except for one person, and then Philip Reed got $1.25 a day. Which you would think is a good deal, right? Back then? Except, of course, what? In 1860, he was what?
Slave.
So who got the $6? He worked like nonstop. The man worked nonstop for 2 years. So who got all the money?
Master.
That's right. So Mills got all the money, except on Sunday, because just like here, slaves did not have to work for their masters on Sunday, but Reed worked anyway on Sunday with the intention of buying his freedom. So every Sunday, 33 Sundays from 1860 to 1862, he worked on Sunday and was paid $1.25 an hour. So in 1862, there was a record of the federal government paying him $41.25 for his work on this on the statue. So we should applaud. Y'all didn't applaud. Of course, that was not enough money to buy his freedom, right? So, in any case, he was the foreman of the whole project. He built the foundry, he put the thing together up until December 5th of 1862, when the D.C. Emancipation Act was passed. That freed all the slaves in D.C. And guess what? The statue was not finished. But what do you think Philip Reed did? He said, see ya, I'm out of here. So he left Mills and the country and everybody hanging. So he was not the guy of record when the statue actually went up 10 months later. I tell you the story about him because of two things. One, when we see a lot of the stuff that goes on here, that is passed on here, is like the history of the city, and then we attribute it to white people and say that they own it or they live in it or whatever. But, you know, who created it? I mean, who created it? And so what we're doing, one of the things that we're doing in addition to training people in these century-old skills, blacksmithing, ironwork, specialty carpentry, and historic brick masonry, one of the things that we're doing with all of our apprentices is we're teaching them an appreciation for ownership of the things that they work on and the things that they do. So that when they take their kids from their neighborhood or their family members or their brothers and sisters around to, you know, Jackson Square or to the Garden District, and they can drive by just like when I ride by with my master craftsman, and they can go, I did that, I did that, and I did that. So our motto, by the way, is not something that you would read in some curriculum at Delgado or some technical college. We're basing our approach on the work of the infinite geniuses of revitalization of trades and art here in New Orleans, Danny Barker and Tuba Fax. So just like Danny and Tuba and all those guys led a revival of brass band music in the 90s, 80s and 90s here, we're doing the very same thing. So we're bringing all the old guys in. They, you know, they drink beer, they do all this stuff. They tell more lies than I can talk about here. But they give the younger guys a sense of ownership and purpose. So that's my story. Remember Philip Reed, whenever you pass through Jackson Square, the French Quarter, he actually built that thing. Oh, I forgot to mention one little thing. You know that Statue of Freedom that's on top of the Capitol building there? Do you know who helped design that? Take a guess. That has relevance to where we are right now. The right senator, racist senator from Mississippi, Jefferson Davis, authorized $100,000 in 1840s to do the expansion of the Capitol building, now with the wings for the House and the Senate or whatever. And the pinnacle of it all was the Statue of Freedom. So the guy who was most associated with trying to deny freedom to, at that time, 4 million of our brothers and sisters, was in charge of designing the Statue of Freedom that is now at the Capitol building. And so there you have it. Bring it all back around, sir.
Awesome. Thank you.
I love how at the very beginning he goes, I'm not good at public speaking, and then just went to town for 20 minutes, and everyone was like writing notes. So he's a very knowledgeable man, but he's also a liar. So remember that about John Hancock.